America. We have an exciting program for you. We will cover the recent shootings, the Brexit vote, and later we will be interviewing David Duhalde. All that and more coming up.
Direction, insight, spin. Welcome to the Compass.
So, there have been a lot of shootings in this past week, and I think we need to go over them and reiterate exactly what happened in each instance and separate the fact from the fancy. So, the first shooting took place on Tuesday. It was a 37-year-old man. His name was Alton Sterling, and he was murdered by a police officer. So here are the facts. So the police were responding to a 911 call regarding a man with a gun. So Alton Sterling was carrying a gun. Now, judging by the video, here's what appears to have happened. The cops commanded him to do something. It wasn't all clear what they were saying, but he was commanded to do something. He didn't follow their directions. Because of this, he was pinned down to the ground. There was a struggle, a bit of a brawl. He was pinned down to the ground. The two officers had pinned him down. It was 2-on-1. They had him on the ground. One officer screamed, "I swear to God." Then there was some sort of unintelligible noise. And then the other police officer that was upper on his torso basically shot him several times in the chest. This seems to have occurred out of pure rage. That is, the police officer took out his anger on his victim. This is not law enforcement's job. It is not their job to enforce their own version of rough justice, so to speak. This was just rage. This wasn't a necessary action. They had him on the ground. He was pinned down on the ground. Basically couldn't do anything. It was 2-on-1. Yes, I will concede it was necessary to get a hold of him. There was a 911 call. He was an armed man, etc. He was pinned down on the ground. Shooting him was completely unnecessary. He was angry with him because he wasn't following his orders, wasn't doing what he said, so he took out his anger on him. The next person who was shot this week, his name was Philando Castile. I think I'm pronouncing that right. Now, here is how the story goes. He was driving in his car, and he was pulled over because of a broken taillight. Now, he was in his car with his daughter and his fiance. Now, the police officer comes up to the window, like in any situation where you're being pulled over for some type of ticket. He, you know, the window's rolled down, etc. And the African-American gentleman, that is Mr. Castile, said, you know, I have a permit to conceal and carry. I have a gun on me, but I'm just getting out my license papers and whatnot. Now, this was recorded by his fiance. So as the officer started began to shoot, which I'll explain in a second, she started recording and she essentially told the story. Now, that is to say, that is how the story comes to us, is directly from her, who took footage of this event. Now, he, that is Mr. Castile, sitting in the car, reaching for his license and registration, that this part was not on footage, so we can't say for sure exactly what happened, but according to his fiance's testimony on the video, just seconds after it happened, he was getting his license registration. The police officer, I guess, somehow thought he was reaching for his gun and then shot him several times. And to me, this was the most interesting part of this. she was recording. She was saying, you know, as he shot him, as the police officer shot him, she was recording. She was saying, you know, I don't want my fiance, I don't want my fiance to die this way. I don't want this to, you know, this is horrible, whatever. And the cop is responding. And he's responding in like a panicked tone, like he's unable to control himself. Like he just starts rambling on. You know, I told him not to take out his gun. You know, I said that kind of a thing. And he sounded absolutely panicked. This makes me concerned for police training. I don't feel that a police officer who reacts this way is a properly trained police officer. I think that there is a lot of undertraining and underfunding for police forces, and that's a lot of the issues that happen with regards to police shootings. It's not necessarily that police officers were racist. I think in the first instance there was definitely some racism involved because it was just a rage tactic. He was outraged by the gentleman he had pinned down, and so he took out his anger by shooting him. In this instance, I think this is more so a situation where there was just poor training. The officer, in a panic, freaking out, you know, turned to his gun rather than his words and shot him. Now we have our last shooting. So this was somebody who claimed to be taking revenge for those two shootings. And while there were peaceful protests in Dallas, Texas, there were police officers kind of marching alongside the protesters, protecting them from, you know, potential outsiders or people who might want to hurt the protesters, that kind of thing. Now, there are a lot of misconceptions about this story, so I'd like to make it very, very clear as to exactly what happened. So, there was only one shooter. Okay, the media and some police sources initially started talking about up to 12 shooters. They were snipers, all that. There were no shooters and snipers. That's not exactly how it happened. Here is the correct story. So, this gentleman, Mr. Johnson, was a veteran of the Afghan War and opened fire on Thursday at police officers who were escorting protesters that were protesting the shootings of black men in America. He killed 5 police officers and injured 7, and he also managed to hurt 2 protesters in the process. There was only one shooter. That's very important here to understand that this was not a hodgepodge of different killers. This was one guy. As described by eyewitnesses, Johnson approached the police and opened fire using an assault rifle. This is then after he opened fire, after he shot the police officers, he fled the scene. Then, in the ensuing hours, he alternately exchanged gunfire with and negotiated with the police. In the end, the police deployed a robot with a remote control bomb strapped to it and killed him. Wow. Now, there are all different theories on exactly what caused him to do this. He was a member of some black nationalist groups. People said that after the Afghan War, he was kind of broken and didn't come home the same, and so on. I'm sure that was definitely a part of it, but I don't feel that it is yet an appropriate time to make these kind of speculations. I think we need to wait for more investigation, perhaps, and then we can start to talk about the issue, the deeper underlying issue of the shooting. But for now, I felt that it was necessary to at least clarify the facts of the matter. So next, I would like to completely switch gears and talk a bit about Puerto Rico. So I was hoping to have a guest on to talk about this, as well as the Brexit vote. That's why I waited until now to have the conversation with you. But unfortunately, the guest that I wanted couldn't appear today. And so I'm just going to be discussing this myself. And I'm sorry then that my take on it has to be so late. So let's just do a recap here, although I'm sure you're familiar with the story by now. So for decades in Puerto Rico, the mass of people, rich and poor, as in every country in the world, want bigger and better services without having to pay more taxes. And the politicians like to get voted into office. So they essentially lie and say, oh, we can, you know, build you new highways or whatever the case may be without raising your taxes. The only way to do that is to go into debt, to take money, to borrow money. That's what they did. They borrowed money at insanely high interest rates from banks in New York, in Boston, etc. Now, in the past couple of weeks, they have their economy has become so bad that they finally declared bankruptcy. So, how are they handling their issue? So, they need to work on trying to repay the debt, although now the task is being handed off to the U.S. government, as I'll explain in a minute. But basically, they are bankrupt. And the mass of people, as usual, are feeling the brunt of the idiocy of the politicians. The most poor area in the United States, that's Puerto Rico, has the highest sales tax at 11% in order to gain revenues in order to pay the debts back. So, essentially now, all of the people, the mass of people, regardless of your income, are feeling the harsh brunt of this economic system. But I am very excited to report that a new bill, with this bill, the Congress and he have a plan to repair Puerto Rico's economy. Oh, wait, that's not at all what it does. Let's see here. What does the bill actually do? It sets up a team of four Republicans and three Democrats. It's an oversight committee that will essentially bring Puerto Rico back into a colonial state. But they will do basically what the Puerto Rican government will do anyway, which is squeeze the people dry for revenues to pay back the debt. Now I'd like to move on to some election issues before we talk about the Brexit vote. So, Donald Trump, like all candidates, if he admits that his policies are only to benefit capital, then there is no chance that he will get elected. So he talks about how he's hired Hispanic workers and he's hired these types of workers. And my workers, they love me. Everybody loves me. Everybody. They all do, right? But here's the reality. And this is an absolutely fascinating interview. You can find this interview on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Wayne Barrett. Here it is.
Foreign Peace Report, we conclude our conversation with Trump biographer Wayne Barrett, who's tracked the Republican presumptive presidential nominee for decades. His biography of Trump has been republished as an ebook. It's called Trump, the Greatest Show on Earth, the Deals, the Downfall, the Reinvention. Juan Gonzalez and I interviewed him last week at his home in Brooklyn. I asked Wayne about those harmed by Trump's business practices, from the Polish workers who built Trump Tower to the investors in the casino he never built in Mexico.
His pathway to success is littered with bodies. You know, I hear him talk about the thousands of Latinos he's employed. I don't know what he's talking about. I'm sure, Juan, you're aware there are almost no Latinos in Atlantic City. You couldn't employ Latinos in Atlantic City. There's a lot of black people there, but it has no significant Latino population. I was in and out of his casinos all the time. I never saw many Latino workers. I don't know where these thousands of Latinos that have supposedly worked for him have worked for him, but it wouldn't be Atlantic City, and I don't know where else he ever employed thousands of people. And certainly the Taj, for example, just talk about the Taj, which was at the time, you know, this is, he had this incredible downfall where his personal life, this is when he dumps his wife and children and goes with Marla at the same time when he was on this fast track, 87, 88. 88 was the disaster year, that, you know, where he makes one bad judgment after another. So he is trying to get the city of New York, Ed Koch, to support the building of the tallest skyscraper in the history of the country on the West Side Yards for NBC headquarters. And at the same time, he takes on the Taj, which will be the largest casino in the history of the world. So he doesn't get the approvals from Koch. So he doesn't build the NBC Tower on the West Side, but he goes ahead and tries to build the Taj. And he so over-leverages everything, junk bonds, adding to cost all over the place. Just one bauble after another. It was just, so it was doomed from the day it opened. It could never make the payments. It could never make the bond payments. And so they stiffed all the bondholders, but they also stiffed all the small contractors in Atlantic City, you know, guys, you know, mom and pop shops who did all the work there. I used to walk through it while it was under construction, and the place was just filled with contractors. I talked to many of them, and they didn't know they were all going to get stiffed in the end, but they got 20 cents, 30 cents on the dollar, or nothing. And he just stiffed so many of them. So small businesses went out of business.
What about the Polish workers at Trump Tower?
The Polish workers at Trump Tower became a kind of famous case. The Bonwit Teller building was part of the site. And this, you know, when you look at that site, this is the genius of Donald Trump, how he managed to assemble that site. It's, you know, I don't think he can find a better site in America, maybe in the world, than the location that he had. So that was part of his genius at the time, was assembling these kinds of sites and making these acquisitions. But he was completely unconcerned about the workers who worked in the demolition of the Bonwit Teller building, who literally slept there. And they were all immigrant Polish workers, hundreds of them, many of whom got very sick as a result of working on that site. He's always tried to put some distance between. But his office was right across the street. His office was, you know, with how he could claim that he didn't know what was going on in that site, which has been his claim. And there's no question but that these workers were abused to an enormous degree.
I have only one word for you after listening to that video, and that is the word that I think Donald Trump would use. Unbelievable. Moving along, we now need to address the Brexit vote. So, basically, England has voted to leave the EU, an organization that was set up after World War II to unite the different cultures and people and to keep peace. But I think that a lot of the news stations and politicians have got it wrong. This issue isn't really about immigrants. It's not really about not liking Europe. Although for some, I'm sure that it is. I think the vast majority of people who voted for leaving the EU were voting for something else. A lot of people were voting for the economy. They're angry that money, public money, was used to bail out banks when the economy crashed, and that now they're being squeezed. That now they're being squeezed with austerity programs to suck the life out of the people. Now, the harsh reality is that whether they're in the EU or whether they're not, they're still going to get hit with the austerity plans. This vote is more of a distraction, more of a tool than anything else. It is a way of getting people to not focus on the imperative issues of restructuring our economy, to asking serious questions on how our society is organized, it blames different groups. But what of this other group that certainly exists? Although what I said a moment ago is most certainly true, that this issue was used by politicians as a distraction, there are many people who are angry with immigrants, with people who have different cultures, with Muslims in the United States, that is, the people who support Donald Trump. Where does their anger come from? I think around the world, we are having a separate conversation, a conversation that we don't even know that we're having. And it's about philosophy. It's about modernism and postmodernism. I think we need to explain, first of all, exactly what those two things are and how they relate in this case. So, for those of you who don't know, modernism, neoclassicalism, the philosophy, the philosophical framework of the Enlightenment. This is the worldview, essentially, that reason and science are eternal truths and thus ought to be the backbone of any society. To use an example, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that reason dictates these truths be so. Postmodernism, that is, the after-modernism, so to speak, questions and or rejects these claims. Reason and science, postmodernism says, are merely constructs of society. To quote the fragments of rationality, there are, quote, no eternal human truths, no universal human experience, no universal human rights, and it goes on. That is the reality for Marx, for Nietzsche, and so on. Philosophers that come after the Enlightenment. It is the idea that although there might be truths about the world, there is no one sort of correct universal method of going about finding those. Although many postmodernists reject the human's ability to even understand truths about the world at all. Who even knows if there are truths about the world? Those are the kinds of questions that postmodernists like to pose. A great way of analyzing this, and you know, this is only a basic run-through of the ideology. We could talk about different postmodernists. And we do talk about postmodernists on this program all the time. You know, I am a Marxist, right, and a political activist fighting for socialism. That is a postmodernist world, a postmodern worldview. It is a rejection of modernism. But to give you a great example that's fairly simple to illustrate, let me turn to feminism, a modernist and a postmodernist view. So a modernist might say, women, they might be oppressed by patriarchy, but reason can be used to gain independence and to gain their true selves. So what does that mean? It emphasizes a couple of things. That number one, women are a certain way. The feminine character is a definable character. It is a true character, and it's about liberating that character. And of course, you will always find modernists who say, well, we don't need a feminist movement because it's already been achieved, and I'm sure you can find postmodernists, although probably much more few in number, who will agree with that. But just to give you the basic premise of the ideas, to a postmodernist, the solution is something more along these lines, that the feminine and masculine are in of themselves a cultural construction. So the liberation of women, if you want to call it that, although of course postmodernists would argue about the use of the word liberation and how liberation is even a relative term, but if I may, the liberation of women would more likely be a struggle to abolish gender roles and distinctions. It's basically the idea that all people and animals are different, and there is no one universal experience to being a certain type anyway. It's one of the reasons why some individuals choose to become vegetarian. Because they say, well, look, animals just have a different way of viewing the world than we humans do. None of them is right or more accurate than the other because we reject the idea of truth, of internal truths. we believe in truth claim. So I make a claim about it, the truth, and then we can argue about it. But we'll never really know for sure because we're only humans. So to bring it back to politics, how does this relate to our modern social structure and the issues that I've been discussing? So here is what I'm getting at. That modernists, and also, I would just say, kind of as a sidebar, a kind of a pre-modernist culture that is sometimes woven in. Pre-modernism is basically the idea that there are eternal truths, there are knowable eternal truths, and those eternal truths can be known through revelation. So if you read the Bible enough times, you'll know everything there is to know about the world. I mean, of course, that's a bit of a juvenile statement, but I think it illustrates the point. It is to use revelation as a method of understanding the world, not reason. Modernism was revolutionary in the sense that it used reason to understand eternal truths, but it didn't question the idea of understanding eternal truths as postmodernism does. But anyway, modernism does often have a religious character woven into it, or oftentimes a religious justification. That is to say, the reason why we ought to use reason is because God gave us reason. God gave us this eternal truth measuring stick that we can use. That's oftentimes a justification, and quite frankly, if I may say so, I can't personally conceive of another justification to use reason, because the epistemologies, empiricism and rationalism, usually are very circular, i.e. empiricism, that is, you understand the world through your experience, is true because reason tells me that. And reason, and I can use reason because my experience tells me that I can use reason. It becomes a circular logical scheme in which one epistemology is used to justify the other. The only way I think that you can really break that problem is to invoke divinity or to invoke revelation. But in any event, as I was saying just a moment ago, how does this relate to the conversation we were having a moment before this about Donald Trump and the Brexit vote? I want to return to something that I said about the modernists in the beginning. And this is the reason why I mentioned this quote. We hold these truths to be self-evident. What does that imply? It implies that if you don't believe in those truths, you're wrong somehow. Let each modernist explain how in their own words, but I will say that you are somehow wrong and your worldview is bad. So modernism, as opposed to postmodernism, remember, you can have a right and a wrong, a pure morality, meaning under modernism, morality isn't relative. Morality is somehow dictated by reason, or if you want to be more pre-modernist, religion or some type of mix of reason and religion. But by some means, we can devise the moral truth. That is wrong because it is wrong. That is wrong because reason tells us it's wrong, and so on. But to a postmodernist, those truths don't exist. So we embrace all different cultures and all different schemes of living because none is better or more right than another. There are no eternal truths about the proper way to live because reason is just a social construct. You might want to use instinct, intuition, as a means of understanding the world and of living your life. That reason is just a choice. It is not an inherent law of the universe. Modernists, of course, as I was explaining, would disagree with that entirely. They would say reason is the inherent truth. And so if your culture or your philosophy comes from the perspective of intuition, religion, perhaps, depending on the modernist you're talking about, or any other spirituality, reflection, meditation, any variety of different other schemes you could come up with, then your worldview is wrong. So, if I may make this into a very juvenile issue, if you believe in different things than I do, you're bad. That's basically, of course, it is a very juvenile interpretation, but that's basically the kind of thing that we're getting at. That's the kind of idea that we're going for. That the certain cultures are just inferior to ours. That the Muslim culture is inferior. That the Mexican culture is inferior. That's the idea, and that's why they are offended by these people coming in. For example, the Syrian refugees. These people, they live differently than we do. They're different. They're unclean. It's not just an assessment of, I know I did use the term different, but it's not just saying they're different, which is just a visible fact that you can just see that they live different lives. But it's a rejection of their way of living and a statement that their way of living is inferior. And that's the kind of philosophical debate that subconsciously I think the Western world especially is having. Because in the Western world, we're seeing an influx in people and ideas that we didn't have before. Consider, and this is an argument, by the way, used by my opponents to advocate for why they do not think that other cultures should come into the United States. They'd say, well, yeah, it's true that people like us were offended by the Irish or by the Italians or by the Germans or so on. But in retrospect, we understand that those anti-immigrant groups, they were just nationalists, they were just this, that, whatever. Our understanding comes from the idea that their culture is different. They're not European. Of course, in America, we're not European per se, but our cultural ideas of the Enlightenment, those truths that we hold self-evident, that's a European modernist Enlightenment idea and theory that the people who are coming into our nation, quite frankly, very well might reject. There's no denying that they reject that. There are some out there who want to say, oh, they don't really live differently than us. They're not really different. That's not true. They do advocate for potentially different epistemologies. They do see the world in a different way. But the trick is, I do not see the different way as any more or less, as any amount superior to the way that I view the world. It is not in any way to say that their picture of the universe is inferior to mine, and therefore we should reject them, that they're un-American. And yes, it is true, they are not American by the typical standard. Once again, I will admit that very, very willingly. Because the argument that we need to have is a philosophical argument about modernism and postmodernism and how we want to view the world moving forward. Now, this argument, I would say furthermore, is interconnected with the class struggle, is interconnected with the Brexit vote, is interconnected deeply with the idea, as I was expressing before, this idea that we want to leave the EU because of austerity and so on. We don't want any more austerity, those material economic problems. This is connected because capital is modernist. Capital relies on a postmodernist theory to keep itself afloat. The right to property comes from modernism. The right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that's a modernist idea. We don't advocate, as a postmodernist, we don't advocate for eternal truths about right and wrong and natural rights and so on. So the whole idea of property, private property, that's justified in either a religious sense or by rationalism or empiricism or something of that nature or some combination of them both. And so it is necessary for capitalism to keep modernism as the dominant power structure, as the dominant philosophy in our society. The rejection of modernism and the embracement of postmodernism will also spell the end of capitalism. And that, friends, is our ray of hope, that if we begin to change our worldviews as individuals, if we begin to question our society and the leaders in it, the authority figures, whether those be professors in universities, politicians, economists, if we begin to question the way that they view the world, perhaps then we will find our path as Americans, as people of the world, to a more free society, a more equal society. Now, after the break, we will be meeting with David Duhalde and discussing foreign policy. Hello, America, and welcome back. I'm your host, Lucas Duransky, and right now you're listening to The Compass. We've been having an interesting conversation about different economies around the world and how they're struggling with the difficult and tumultuous economic times. But I thought it would also be valuable to have a good conversation about what's going on other than that in the world of foreign policy, explicitly terrorism and immigration. In order to do that, I have Deputy Director of the Democratic Socialists of America, David Duhalde, on with me today. Hi, David.
Hi, Lucas. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you. You're a great leader for the Young Democratic Socialists, and I'm excited to discuss with you about what's going on with foreign policy. I do want to add that these opinions are my own. They are not officially the Democratic Socialists of America opinions unless I explicitly say that I am speaking on behalf of an official statement. So just want to throw that out there, and I look forward to a fruitful discussion.
Great. I'm very happy to have you on my show. So, immigration. As socialists, I think we can agree, just to start out with, that the immigrants, the undocumented immigrants who most likely crossed over the border between Mexico and the United States, should be granted citizenship because this is good for both them and Americans. They would then pay taxes. They would then be able to form unions, which would be better for the working class as a whole, and so on. So can we agree on that to start out with?
So what I would say is we definitely can agree that making sure that people don't exist in the shadows is a key first step towards a sane immigration policy. So, for example, one of the huge kind of issues that undermine all workers is that undocumented workers live in constant fear of repercussions of being deported, to exercising very basic labor rights that they're entitled to, not even things that, you know, you and I as socialists say they should be entitled to, but just the basic worker rights that exist under the current law, because they know that an employer can exert punitive damages, such as it ultimately leading to deportation of a worker. So when those workers are scared, it undermines the ability for all workers to fight back, because there's this lower class of laborer that can ultimately be much more exploited, even not in their own free will, then it undermines the kind of bargaining power, the labor rights standards, and other things that come with a strong trade union movement, and even for non-unionized workers when workers live in the shadows. So I think that that's the first step we have to work towards, and then we have to kind of working towards a sane immigration policy kind of will have to also not factor in what's happening to us as the United States. And I think that's been a huge issue that you see why it's very difficult to find solutions for immigration that really seem to be sustainable or just, is because the foreign policy of the United States often looks like what's happening to us. And it doesn't look at what we're doing to other people, how things act in a global economy, what are the pushes and pulls. So, for example, some of the reasons the Obama administration probably didn't have to deal with as much the immigrant issues in the beginning of their administration was simply because the United States was in a deep recession, and it was actually lowering immigration rates to the United States. So that's a huge thing that people kind of just pleasantly avoided talking about, and that a lot of the reasons that Central American and Mexican immigrants are coming to the United States is because of free trade agreements that have devastated their local agricultural economies and kind of left them with no choices but to take these extremely risky routes to the United States for a better life. I mean, it's hard enough for us to get people to come to the YDS conference on a bus. So I think that you can imagine if people are, you know, risking life and limb to come to the United States, it must be for a very good reason. So two issues I see right away are, one, that we have to work to make sure to humanize and create a sense of citizenship, whether it's with, and by that I mean not necessarily like a, making people, giving people voting rights, but giving people a sense that they are Americans, that they are not just like this other. So a citizenship in the traditional sense of like we're all together for undocumented immigrants as part of this culture, and also to kind of figure out how we can develop a foreign policy that relates to actually looking at what the United States does and to the other people and being more honest about if there are negative implications. So I just want to kind of start the conversation there and kind of see what other questions you may have.
Right. So for me, whenever I have a conversation with somebody, whether it's on the show or just, you know, out and about immigration, it seems to always be divided into two issues. And so that's how I think we ought to express it on this show. There's the issue of, number one, what do we do with the people who are already in the country? So for those I don't want to say Americans because they haven't been granted citizenship, but for those undocumented individuals here, what is our solution to that conundrum versus how do we keep people or allow people, depending on your point of view, from entering into the country illegally? And I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned something in your answer to the first question that I want to ask you about. So to me, I always feel that it's imperative that when we grant citizenship or some type of citizenship to those who are undocumented in America, that we grant them the right to vote, because the decisions that are made in this country affect those immigrants. Whether they have paperwork or not, they're being directly affected by the elections and by the people who are voted in. And I think it's important that their voice be heard in that arena. And I do you disagree with me on that point?
Do I disagree with you about the pathway to citizenship?
No. I mean, do you disagree with me that they should be granted the right to vote? Because you mentioned that in your answer, and I thought that was an interesting.
Okay, yeah, I think I understood what you're saying. I just phrased it differently than you would. Yeah, I do think that ultimately one of the things I learned that DSA promotes, this is where I'm going to distinguish between necessarily what I think and what DSA thinks, is DSA is very much, if you read our strategy document, very much says that, like, when people are residents of a place, they should have a right to vote, like permanent residents. And it comes from the democratic principle that, you know, decisions are being made that affect them, and they are part of the society that's kind of that, and they are so creating wealth, and or they are partaking in some way that helps facilitate, you know, the function of their home, their neighborhood, their city, their country. And so I think, like, one of the more interesting, very democratic principles of the United States that exists, at least in New York, is that, you know, if you have a child in the school system, you don't have to be a citizen to vote on school board elections, which makes total sense. You know, it shouldn't be people, childless citizens, deciding what's best for children and not leaving that to parents. So I definitely think that, you know, allowing immigrants a quicker path to, you know, the franchise, you know, to use a fancier word for like the right to vote, is really key. I think that it does, you know, there are questions to deal with, like, well, what's a rational immigration policy, in the sense that we, of course, in principle support the free movements of people, but can you imagine if 10 million people move to D.C. overnight. You know, it doesn't have the capacity to deal with that. It doesn't have the welfare state to, you know, service all those people. So there has to be. So that's why socialists aren't against rules and regulations. I mean, that's always the swipe against us, and that we are definitely for, like, you know, rules and regulations about immigration and migration. But what we our critique is that under the current capitalist system of global and economic development, it's extremely unfair to hold workers to the same standards you hold, that you don't hold actually capital to. Capital can move very freely, but workers who suffer from the decisions of capital or could gain from new jobs aren't allowed the same movements as, you know, capital. So it comes down to an issue of equity and fairness, and that until there is a system that's, you know, as Sanders talks about, until there's fair trade, you know, you can't really hold it against people who are coming here as undocumented immigrants. And so so there's two distinct discussions that I'm trying to get at. One is what we need to do right now. It's the normative discussion. And then there's the positive analysis of what should be and, like, what would be a fair and humane immigration policy under a social democratic and ultimately socialist global economy. I think those are very distinct questions. So I'm throwing that at you in the sense that I feel like it's important to make those distinctions, because, I mean, what you and I think should be, like, Sanders' immigration policy now shouldn't be some socialist utopia where everyone moves freely and, you know, there's just cornucopias of food, so it doesn't matter where people go. You know, you have to deal with the immigration issues that are most pressing, like how to end Obama's deportations, how to make sure that the farm workers have rights, and also how to make sure that, you know, we aren't letting in people who are dangerous to this country, which is frankly always hyperbolic and overblown rhetoric. So, for example, like, that deals with, like, how do you deal with the Syrian refugees crisis? Like, that's a legitimate question, because, I mean, if it wasn't for American foreign policy helps contribute to Syria, American foreign policy could help resolve some of those issues in Syria. Right. And then so the United States has some bearing and responsibility to take in Syrian immigrants, which was really a great tragedy that happened a few months ago that no one's talking about anymore, about, you know, how essentially we left thousands of people out to dry. You know,
I want to cut you off there, David. Because we will be getting to the issue of Syrian refugees soon enough. Okay. So I'd like to steer away from that path for a moment. So what I'd like to ask you about is this. So to digress a bit, Americans in general, I think, are turned off by, not all, but many Americans are often turned off by left-wing foreign policy messages for the reason that you just expressed. They oftentimes sound utopian, and they say, there's no concern about me, the already existing American, who might lose his job because of an undocumented immigrant, whatever. So what I'd like to ask you about is people moving over the border. I think we can agree, because we are not in a socialist society, we cannot just allow people to just cross over the border, because, like you said a minute ago, there are not just cornucopias of food everywhere where it doesn't really matter where you live. So what do you think we ought to do to humanely prevent a migration of undocumented people to move into this country?
Well, I think the simplest answer would actually kind of maybe be a libertarian answer, and that we have to make it easier for people to come. I mean, in the sense that, I'm going to answer this as simple, like, supply and demand. There's clearly a demand for labor. So there's clearly people are hiring these folks. And one thing, you know, some of your listeners may not know is one of the great compromises of the 1980s in immigration reform was that there would be this general amnesty for undocumented people. And the Reagan administration said, as part of this compromise, but from now on, we're really going to really, really enforce, you know, employers doing background checks. And essentially, this is the great studies of public policy versus lawmaking. Because lawmaking, you pass a law, but public policy is the implementation of the law. And essentially, the Reagan administration and others just ignored that ruling. They never really enforced the employer punitive side, which would be the key way to stop undocumented immigration, if you really wanted to, is not the poor people coming in because they're desperate. It's you would make it harder for employers to hire them, you know, because the employers, it's easier to, because these are citizens, these are people who pay taxes, these are businesses, they're easier targets than undocumented workers. But because we live in a capitalist society where those employers have lobbies, they have business associations, they have a lot of, they have influence, you know, they don't become the natural target. So you would have to, I think, make it easier for people to come in to essentially have realistic senses of, you know, accounting for like who wants to come in this country. Because once it's, because if people are then legal residents, you know, it would be much easier for them to exert their labor rights, like I said earlier, fight for unions, combat, you know, mistreatment by the bosses. And it would force employers to also, you know, not pay into fake Social Security counts, not skirt the law. So it would be a two-pronged thing. One would be like, you would probably, if you didn't want undocumented workers hired, you know, the realistic thing would be to do is then to like have employers not hire them. that would be, but that's not what I'm advocating for. What I'm advocating for is, I think, to have a much more realistic quota system, or even though quotas, we don't do immigration like quotas anymore, but realistic numbers of people who can come in and how long they can stay for. Do people get like certain types of visas, things like that? Because you always notice business fights very hard for like these, like, these special, like, I think they're like the H1N1 visas, or no, that's something else. But sort of, they fight for the visas for the very specially trained people, and because they don't feel like they're trained, because they say America's not training enough, you know, people at the fields that on science and computer science that they need. But so it's not like people can't kind of come together and figure out policies that work for business. So we have to move them. Well, this is what works for all working people. What works for the working class of both Americas and non-Americans. And I think that's what we need to move forward to. So it's a long-winded answer, essentially saying, I think like we have to kind of relax some of the limitations we have, but also and that allow people to work here freely. The one thing I will add, though, is I'm very much against, like, DSA is too, and so is Bernie Sanders, and the unions were against guest worker programs, because guest worker programs really do undermine labor rights. They're just, like, formalizing a second-class citizenship. So that's why when Sanders was against immigration reform, so in the bill that was formed, we supported him, because we felt it was kind of going to create a permanent underclass. And these kind of systems have existed before in the United States and are unpopular with those communities at the time.
All right, that is a fantastic answer, and I thought that was really fascinating. So I do want to move on now, though, to the next issue, because I think we addressed immigration very clearly there as to a good policy for taking in immigrants and a solid philosophy for how to deal with the current undocumented immigrants who are already in this country. So now I want to move on to a bit about the Syrian refugees. So what do you think is a reasonable number for how many Syrian refugees we should take in? Should we take in any at all? And if so, why or why not?
Sure. So I think, as I was articulating earlier, I do think we have a moral obligation to take in some Syrian refugees. Our Canadian brothers and sisters did. I think the United States, if the United States acts as a global power, the United States has to then act as a global carer. And by that I mean not in the paternalistic way of, you know, it's our noblesse oblige, it's our manifest destiny, all those horrible imperialist ideas, but that our foreign policy has both positive and negative impacts, more negative in certain ways, we would argue, than positive. And the United States then has a responsibility to deal with some of the consequences. So if the United States wants to get involved with Syria, as the Obama administration has been involved, then the United States should help Syrian immigrants Syrian refugees. I mean, there's a big difference between the immigrant and the refugee. Refugees fleeing for non-economic reasons in situations they can't stay in forever. So clearly there's a moral imperative for the United States to accept Syrian refugees. How many? I mean, your guess is as good as mine. I think that I kind of feel like those questions, and I kind of give respect to Senator Sanders again,
when he pushed back on people asking him about, you know, how would you break up the banks? He's like, well, won't the banks have a better sense of doing that? And he was ridiculed, but every financial analyst who wasn't a hack said, like, no, he's right. Like, you need, there's no way that he would have a sense of what to do better than the bank. So I think, like, there's no, I don't have the knowledge of how many people we should take in. I think that would be, have to be done more. I don't even think the federal government would know. I think because it's not the federal government who would necessarily take people in. It would be states and cities. So you would have to work with states and cities to give them benefits, how many people you can take in, how does that affect other refugee populations. You're dealing with your own citizens, you're dealing with who need resources to, who would pay for it. You know, there are real questions that, you know, I can't answer that I think are reasonable for cities and states to want to have answered. But I mean, there were clearly cities and states who didn't want refugees at all, and there were cities and states who were very open to it. And so there's also, you have to work to make sure you weren't dealing just with, you had to move past the demagogues and the kind of the hate mongers who are using this to score votes, which is not always easy.
Right. Right. So on that point that you were just making about the, as you put it, the demagogues who are afraid of the culture and whatnot, what do you say to the claim that we just can't take these people in because their culture just doesn't match their culture and that they just won't assimilate or whatever the rhetoric is?
I would say that I feel we hear this every 5 to 10 years about some immigrant group, and it just doesn't prove out. I mean, I think that, you know, you know, there's American culture is like, it's a salad, it's not a melting pot. I mean, that's the new thing we say. It's not just one thing. It's distinct groups who come together to form something bigger. But if you move away from those simplistic analogies, like, people do assimilate, especially kids quickly assimilate. You know, it's very rare to see an immigrant kid who doesn't have an American accent, you know, related after a certain age, related to, like, whatever community he's in, with Henry Kissinger always being the great exception, who, like, never lost his accent. And I think that, you know, it's just kind of based in this, like, this very bigoted assumption that it's been levied against Jews, the Irish, the Italians especially, you know, for years, and it's hard to imagine now, but I mean, Italians effectively were not white when they came to this country. And now, I mean, Italians are considered white socially, and these are social constructs in the same way that certain Arab communities, who some of us might say are people of color, actually are considered white by the census. So, long story short, I think that the idea that people can't assimilate is often either at best an excuse to not want to deal with the problem, and at worst, like, this cliche racist bigotry that is spewed by certain segments, and often sadly, which it's not, it's usually by the more recent immigrant group picking on the other recent immigrant group, so they can be they can feel more assimilated. So we shall see, but that's my 2 cents on that.
All right, so I would like to completely switch gears now.
Okay.
And move overseas, all right? And I'd like to talk a bit about terrorism and ISIS. So I know that you are, as I am, opposed to U.S. imperialism around the world, but I think a lot of Americans, especially in this election season, are really afraid of terrorism, ISIS, and related groups of that sort. And so I'd like to address a bit about what is a reasonable way to act toward these groups. What is our solution? So first, I would like to know, should we be using military force of some kind to defeat or impair ISIS?
So that's a great question, and I think that there is kind of many different things you need to look at. So one is, like, the idea that ISIS is kind of like a brand. I think that's important to remember too, in the sense that it's actually, it's like a McDonald's franchise, where it's like, there's not, it's not the American Army, where, like, you can attack, the American Army is a clear organization that has, like, divisions, and there's a round, so if you're attacking the American Army, you know, you can really start attacking one central thing. ISIS is, like, independent franchises around the globe, and so I think that's important to think about when you're thinking about a strategy, because, like, if you blow up one McDonald's franchise, you're actually not affecting corporate in the same way. They might not even care that much or have that much interest in getting rid of it. Where it's like the United States, like, you want attack on one is attack on all. And you can really draw the United States out into war if you wanted to. So I'm not sure, honestly, military intervention is the best thing to do, as much as things like intelligence gathering to arrest people who are involved in ISIS, working with communities that are susceptible to ISIS recruitment to, like, win over their hearts and minds.
If I want to interrupt you on yeah. something that you just said. You just mentioned working with communities who might be, I think you used the word susceptible, right, to yeah. ISIS yeah. language or message. How would you be able to determine that? Wouldn't that inevitably involve some type of racial or ethnic profiling?
Well, no, because the communities that are susceptible to those messages are communities where the ISIS is based. So you'd be working, like, in Iraq, and you'd be working with, like, very, very specific people they recruit from. So you're talking about young guys who are disconnected from the labor market, you know, so working with them to, could be just providing jobs. I mean, finding jobs for people, finding things that people need. Because I think a lot of the reason why people got attracted to Islamic fundamentalism is partly based, and you look at Hezbollah in Lebanon, is that they provided services for when the state couldn't. When Arab socialism largely failed, and Arab socialism is not democratic socialism, by the way, it's very specific nationalistic socialism that was like the Ba'ath Party in Syria and Iraq. You know, when those institutions fail, people turn to other things to provide for them. And one thing that Arab socialism tried to provide was at least like a welfare state, or at least like guaranteed job programs that could keep people away from terrorism. So it's not racial profiling if you're talking about specific countries, and especially you're talking more about, less about religion, because of these states are so overwhelmingly Islamic. You're not talking about just race, because it's like these are diverse communities. You're talking about specifically who is attracted to ISIS. It's like young people were recruited to be their soldiers, and they need alternatives because they're disconnected from the labor market, or they feel alienated from other things. So, for example, people get recruited in Europe often are totally alienated. And I think that there's a for all we kind of like make fun of America, you know, people are like, America's racist, America's that. Like, America actually, the aggregate, is much more accepting of different cultures than certain Europeans. And I think that gets lost because these Europeans used to kind of judge the United States for our racism when they are more homogeneous. But the United States has a tradition of being much more accepting in the aggregate. Like, yes, there are racist people like Trump, but even Trump is not saying that there shouldn't be citizenship for people of color. There's he's very anti-Muslim, and that's really scary. But even most Republicans would not say Muslims aren't citizens. And I think that's why Colin Powell and John McCain, now it's 8 years ago, really pushed back on this idea that Muslims couldn't serve in the army, because it was, one, they were, and two, it really undermined morale. So whereas I think there's a lot more bigotry and isolation for, you know, young Muslim communities in Europe, which creates a sense of alienation and breeds terrorism. So making, kind of combating those, by that means a lot of combating the way non-Muslims think and how they interact with those communities, because I think there's always this tendency of, like, they isolate themselves. It's like, no, it's probably a little bit of both. So probably also people aren't super welcoming either. And I think after the Brexit vote, with all the increase of, like, hate crimes in England, shows that it's definitely not there's reasons why Muslims or maybe feel a little scared and want to isolate themselves if they're constantly under attack.
So if I can get just a touch philosophical for a second, what you're advocating, or what you're expressing, I should say, is this, that it is primarily the material reality that these individuals find themselves in. You mentioned alienation, not be you, they don't have a job, they don't have job prospect, etc. This is what ISIS is feeding off of. But do you think that at the root of ISIS is a deeper ideological problem? Do you think that Islam is in part responsible for ISIS?
No, I don't think Islam is responsible for ISIS, because Islam is a religion with over a billion followers. I mean, it's not something that has a center of accountability. I think people who create ISIS are responsible for ISIS. I think capitalism isn't responsible for global imperialism the same way that's the people who run capital are responsible. Like, you can't kind of hold ideas accountable. You have to hold structures and people accountable. And I think that's the unhealthy nature of, like, these blanket, like, questions of, like, frankly, I mean, I'm going to be a little blunt here, like, get to the kind of the blood libel thing. Like, are Jews, that comes to the idea that Jews are responsible for the killing of Christ. You know, it's like, you can't hold, like, entire communities and ideologies responsible for the actions of a very small segment of people who are acting on behalf of a very narrow interpretation of a religion. I mean, ISIS recently just killed a lot of Muslims in Bangladesh, and I think they're, and I don't know who was behind, because I just haven't been following too closely, but there was an attack in Medina, which is a very holy city in Saudi Arabia. So it's not like Islam is not, is that all Islam's fault? No, it's the actions of a few, you know, maniacs and a few terrorists who are, you know, scaring lots of other people too. I mean, that's the goal of terrorism, is to strike fear, and you can't hold entire, you know, amorphous ideologies responsible for it.
So I want to ask you about something that you just mentioned. You don't, I know this is a bit of a digression, but you don't feel that capitalism as a system is responsible for imperialism around the world? See, I always felt that capitalism leads into imperialism, that free market capitalism, in the same way, I mean, free market capitalism eventually leads to capital getting help from the government, capital welfare, if you want to call it that, that these structures form from the system of capitalism. You don't agree with that?
No, you're playing semantics. What I'm saying is that it's not, the idea of capitalism doesn't cause these things. This institution of capitalism and people using it cause these things. The same way Islam is not like some amorphous mass religion is not responsible for ISIS in the same way that capitalism as an amorphous idea is not responsible for imperialism. It's like people using systems, people using the ideologies as an excuse, and very specific people are responsible. Because I just think it's like an unhealthy kind of blanket thing to be like, you know, capitalism causes imperialism. Sure, it does. I mean, does Islam cause ISIS? No. You know, I think Muslims who follow ISIS cause ISIS.
Right. Okay. I just wanted to clarify that point. So I now I want to change gears again. We've had a little bit of a conversation about the general form of terrorism and how to basically go about protecting the American, protecting Americans, and so on. To what extent do you think U.S. imperialism has fueled ISIS or radical Islam, if at all?
I mean, I think it's pretty clear that if you look at history, there's a great segment in, I don't think you would know the movie as well, but I think it's like Rambo 3, when they go to Afghanistan and they dedicate the movie to the brown soldiers of the Mujahideen, who the Mujahideen later become the Taliban. And that here was a time when the United States was very close to Islamic fundamentalists, because they had a common enemy of the Soviet Union and communism. So I think that, you know, U.S. imperialism and U.S. foreign policy bear a huge impact on the power of Islamic terrorism because we worked with them so closely when we had common enemies. And now that we don't have common enemies, we never really accounted for, you know, ways to win over with the hearts and minds of people who are deeply negatively affected by our ideology and our self-interest. So we bear responsibility in kind of creating climates that not only allow these people to flourish when we're their allies, but then don't have nothing to combat them or attenuate their strengths once they're our enemies. So I think there's some responsibility there.
And lastly, just as a kind of maybe just an intellectual venture, if you will, I've always been curious as to what people think on this point. What do you think was the last war the United States fought in that was necessary for the United States to actively military interfere in?
Well, that's a question I could say you could ask for whose interest. Like, the United States might say that they... You know, the United States government has always said, like, to maintain our power, we need to fight wars. Like, I think that we can agree that what didn't really work out for the United States when we went to war in Iraq, because it didn't actually make the United States any stronger. It actually just weakened the United States' power in the globe. But if it's like, well, so I think the question that your question doesn't include is like, for whose standard was it, like, to make the world safe? Was
it that? You're right. Let me amend my question then, because you're exactly right. War, and I would even go so far as to say morality and so on, it's all perspective. It's all whose side are you on, so to speak, and usually the winners write the history books. But let me amend my question to this. Mm-hmm. Let me reference something that I saw a few nights ago on Bill Maher's program Real Time. The Libertarian presidential nominee was speaking to Bill Maher, and he said something along the lines of, I thought this was perfect, it's called a defense budget, and it's not called an offense budget. And the reason why is because it's supposed to defend our country. So let me amend my statement to this. What do you think was the last U.S. struggle, a military struggle, that the United States was involved in that was necessary to defend our borders or our security, not, you know, U.S. interests around the world? Because I think that that's usually just code for corporate power or capital interests.
Like, I think that... I mean, the cliche answer is always World War II, because, I mean, I really do think that was a critical war to defeat fascism, and I think that, you know, the United States was in the right to, you know, get involved in that war, got involved a little too late. But it was, and the Soviet Union bore the greater brunt of the fatalities and casualties to defeat Nazism, and the United States took on more of the roles in defeating the Japanese fascists. But since then, I mean, there's different wars that have had different degrees of wrongness to them. And I think, like, for example, I think if we look at Desert Storm, you know, we can be a little more nuanced. You know, the Iraq invaded Kuwait. Kuwait was not a great country. It was to defend the United States interests, but it wasn't as if, you know, the Kuwaitis wanted to be part of Iraq. And so I think there's sometimes you have to remember. Whereas I think the second Iraq war was incredibly unjust because we weren't invited in by the Iraqis. And none of the predictions that the neoconservatives gave came true. And everything people in DSA, Jeremy Corbyn, and others said, which go wrong, did go wrong. You know, so I think, like, it's one thing to be like, no, it's one thing to have the United States, and at the time the Soviet Union too, to oppose Saddam Hussein overtaking another country. Whether the United States is doing that because it actually cares about the Kuwaitis or was oil interests, you know, that's not even debatable. It's very clear that we were doing it because of the oil interests. We didn't stick up for the East Timorese when the Indonesians invaded them. But it doesn't mean there's always bad things that come out of that. So I think that's why, you know, I'm not a pacifist. And I don't always, and I'm critical of U.S. foreign policy, but I don't think U.S. foreign policy is always so black and white, you know, as people on the left may make it out to be. So I just think that's why I'm in DSA. I think DSA asks the harder questions.
So thanks for being on my show, David.
Thank you for having me. This was really good.
It was great speaking with you. All right, that's all we have for you today. From Port Washington, New York. Good night, America.